Our guest now is a voice of authority on the relationship between what we eat and how well our brain works, specifically the effects of natural products, nutrients, nutraceuticals, supplements and food on the mood, brain function and well-being of the human being, as well as the effects of caffeine, drugs and alcohol. With all this, Andrew Scholey is attempting to understand how we can enhance our cognition and delay the decline that comes with age. Andrew Scholey is a professor of human psychopharmacology at Swinburne University in Melbourne. Before this, he established the Human Cognitive Neuroscience Unit at Northumbria University in the UK, today known as the Brain Performance and Nutrition Research Centre. He was also co-director of the UK's Medicinal Plant Research Centre and remains honorary director of neurocognitive trials there. Having worked with some of the big-name food and drink companies around the world, such as Nestle, Andrew's just joined the Auckland food tech start-up Arepa in Grey Lynn. He's their chief science officer overseeing the R&D of a drink made with blackcurrants, which promises clear thinking during moments of pressure and stress. Andrew is with us from Melbourne. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
It's an extensive career you've had in academia and also with food companies, and I wonder if you mind just a bit of a conversation about the latter at the outset. Could you tell us a little more of your previous work with food companies, who you've worked for, and what the role of a scientist is within commercial companies?
That's a great question, and actually not one that I get very often. I'm primarily a scientist who spent, going back a long way, probably two decades or more, looking at the interaction between nutrition and brain function. And although most of the measures that people look, I've had a pretty kind of successful career. One thing that's can be quite frustrating, I think, is the translational aspects of this. So that's actually trying to get the results of research out there for the public good. And so quite often you feel as though you're banging your head against a brick wall trying to do that, both in terms of the benefits for companies, I guess, I'm less interested in, but the benefits for end users, so people being able to look at claims made about certain products in my area for brain health and have some sort of faith in the credibility of those claims. And that's in the past, as you say, I've worked for or worked with some of the big global 500, but in some ways, some of the smaller companies like Arepa, who are really committed to using the science, is something that's I'm very much in favour of. And this is something where, it's possible just to divert any funds into marketing, and that's one way of getting products to fly off the shelves. But I'm really impressed by the way that this company are trying to use research and evidence to back up any health claims.
Can we, and let me acknowledge again your academic credentials, but again, just to help us deal with the scepticism that we all have to deal with in marketing, many people are naturally wary of science or research that's funded by big industries with vested interests, and with good reason, from oil to tobacco to beauty products to food. There is a history there. We all remember that, it's fat that's a problem, not sugar and carbohydrates that's the problem battle. So can you describe from your own experience and reasonably, recent experience, not the 1950s, the relationship between the funder, the scientist, and the science and research done?
Yeah, look, I think it's a really good point, well made, and I'm also very sceptical as well about some of the claims made by certain companies, including food companies. And there's always this tension, I think, between marketing and science. My kind of take on it is I think that people have to scrutinize the science, perhaps even more so if there's an industry backer. I'm all for that. That can only help people like me. I feel that, you have to trust the science, not the funder. There are all sorts of checks and balances in place these days, which make it actually very difficult to game the system if anybody wanted to do that. So you register your clinical trial on a public registry, so you can say exactly what it is you're looking for, so you can't fish around in the data to try and find a good result amongst a sea of bad results. I think we're in a position where, certainly in Australia, the government funding bodies, the NHMRC and the ARC, their hit rate, in other words, the number of funded projects per applications, is around 10%. So that's 90% of research applications don't get funded. It's important to work with industry to do good science, but it's very important not to compromise the science.
Can we talk about some of the definitions that are used when we talk about the role of food? We used to just use the word nutrition, I guess, and good health and vitamins and minerals and the right balance of fats and proteins and carbohydrates. We're getting into different levels now of detail, psychopharmacology, biobehaviour, nutraceuticals. Could you give us a run through some of the big concepts that are being researched?
Yeah, well, there are all sorts of health benefits of nutrition. And these range from things like, cardiovascular health, heart health, and what I'm interested in, and brain health. And these are all interrelated, actually. So a good, good shorthand is that what's good for the heart is good for the brain. In the context of my research, I'm interested in two things. One is the way in which we can possibly offset and delay the cognitive decline that occurs with aging. So, we all experience certain aspects of this as we get a bit older, things like not being able to put a name to a face, walking into a room and forgetting exactly what it was that you were walked into the room for, or, just sort of lapses in concentration and what we call the psychologist's attention. And it turns out that the pharmaceutical approach to cognitive decline and dementia has been spectacularly unsuccessful. It's really been a failing of the pharmaceutical approach to cognitive decline. And it turns out that there are certain components of food, ranging from whole diets like the Mediterranean diet and some of the kind of components of food that are also found in certain native New Zealand species. So it might be that there'll be an Mediterranean diet in the future, which may also benefit the heart and the brain. It turns out that these foods have a multitude of properties rather than a single property. So it's not like a magic bullet that you send into the body that targets a single chemical in the brain, but these have multiple effects. So for example, New Zealand berries have, they're loaded with vitamin C, which we know can benefit brain function, particularly in things like recovering from surgery. They have these polyphenols, which we know are important components of fruit and veg, which seem to be partially responsible for their health benefits. And in the case of the berry that this company Arepa used, they also have this really interesting property, which is that they inhibit monoamine oxidase, which I won't go into the technical side of it, but this is exactly the same mechanism that some antidepressants use, and also some treatments for certain neurodegenerative diseases. So that's what makes them extremely interesting to me.
What's the scale? The scale, though, Andrew? Let's just stay with that point. What's the scale between a food having, and that's what we're talking about, a food, not a drug. We might talk more about things that are half in between in a moment. A food having certain properties that might target an enzyme, say, and having it on anything like the scale that will make a measurable difference. We remember the antioxidants, you know. And that broad term was put out there. It's going to solve everything. And then you find out that you would have to have, I don't know, 70 litres of a certain concentrated product a day to have a minuscule impact, right? So when we talk broadly about these things being good for us, what is the scientific research that argues they may make a measurable difference on outcome?
Excellent question. And again, this is sort of one of the reasons that really got me excited. So if you look at and you're absolutely right, you know, the antioxidant story, you know, was a kind of, you know, it was a distraction, although there are some antioxidant effects of certain foods. Quite often the antioxidant properties they're sort of disappear because it's all very well looking at these effects in a Petri dish, but when you actually look at them in a physiological system, in a mammal, including in a human, those effects go because the antioxidant properties sort of are minimized, if not completely abolished in the gut. So in the case of, well, let's talk about what I was talking about, this monoamine oxidase inhibition from the berries. That is when you feed humans with a couple of hundred grams of these berries, which is like, you know, handful or two, you get total and reversible inhibition of monoamine oxidase within 15 minutes, which lasts for 4 hours. So that's extremely profound and very, very promising in terms of brain function. And that's a published study, Anthony Watson, 2020, published in Nutritional Neuroscience, where you can look at what we call the pharmacokinetics of these effects.
So it's one published study, but let's follow it through, Andrew. That's one published study for start, so you'd be wanting many more. But second,
of course,
Was it a handful of berries? What was the volume?
I don't know about the volume. I think it was 150 grams.
Okay,
so it's a serve.
That's a fair handful.
And that's
so if you had that every 4 hours, including during the night, are you saying you could completely inhibit this particular, an enzyme that may play a role in what again?
Well, it's an enzyme which it prevents the breakdown of certain neurotransmitters. So it effectively props up the levels. And look, you're right. More research needs to be done. In that particular study, I talked about 4 hours. Actually, they stopped testing at 4 hours. And by the way, this isn't my work. I'm not sort of blowing my own trumpet here. I'm just sort of disseminating other people's research. They stopped testing at 4 hours, and then they tested again at 24 hours, by which time this activity had returned to baseline. So we don't know what happens between 4 and 24 hours, and that's going to be a new trial, I hope.
Let's stay with this one example right now, one study showing this effect so far. And if you were to add that into the long-term health effects on an individual, this is the next thing. If it is, correct me again, an enzyme, if it inhibits an enzyme that causes a breakdown in, I've lost track again, causes a breakdown in...
Okay, maybe I can put it another way. The effect of this, of inhibiting this enzyme,
is that it
increases levels of a class of neurotransmitters called monoamines.
Yes.
So sort of dopamine is the one people have heard of. Serotonin is another.
Right.
These are
happy chemicals.
The same, actually, the same chemical transmitters in the brain that caffeine switches on by a different mechanism, actually. So
stay with me. We know them as our happy chemicals. They are chemicals that give us a sense of well-being, or even a bit of a thrill in the case of dopamine. So if you look at this as feeding through from, yes, I'm having this, it's having this effect on inhibiting this enzyme, are you saying it could have an impact sufficient to affect mood. That's what I'm saying. Can we take the initial study and follow it through all the way to saying it may help mood?
Yeah, that's exactly what.
Right.
That's exactly what we can say. And in fact, and the other sort of dimension to this is the work on human mood and cognitive function, which is, I guess, much more my area. I mean, I'm not a, you know, I'm not an expert on the sort of, you know, the way in which enzymes interact in the body. But I have published quite a bit on various effects on mood and mental function of nutritional interventions. And so the flip side of this, which is a different study, looking at the effects, particularly on cognitive function, shows that this arepa berry can improve attention over, you know, again, during the testing period, around an hour. And these effects are, just to give you some sort of, you know, comparison, these effects are pretty much of the same magnitude as you would get with caffeine. So these are, sorry, these are also, I should emphasize, these are acute effects. So these are the effects following a single dose. Now, there is other research that is pretty exciting on the berries, but I'm not, you know, I'm not really going to talk about stuff that hasn't been peer reviewed yet. I'm very reluctant to do that.
I'm really thank you for your patience, because what it is doing is helping us address how we can get from an isolated effect in research and then track through as to whether it actually has a measurable impact on the human mood and experience. Because that is where there is scepticism, and we know there are bottles and bottles and bottles of supplements saying we've got this ingredient. The question is whether they do any more than change the colour of your output at the end of the day, all right? So thank you for being patient in working through this research shows a measurable impact. And the comparison with caffeine we can all recognise. Yeah. You've also done some work on guarana, I think, as well, which anyone who's pumped V ahead of any stressful event or pulling an all-nighter knows definitely has an effect, but equally has a downside. Potentially a downside, particularly if you overdose on it. Could you speak to guarana for a moment, and then I'm going to let you talk generally about any number of mood enhancers. But could you speak to a little of your experience with guarana?
Yeah, I can. So yeah, believe me, Catherine, I'm as anti people making claims where there isn't any evidence to back it up as anyone. You know, it's a real bugbear of mine. And it kind of, you know, in some ways, you know, it means that I have to spend, you know, time that I'd rather spend on other things, having to justify the good stuff, if that makes sense. But I, you know, I completely agree that the sort of regulatory framework here really needs to be tightened up, particularly in sort of, you know, well, globally, I think. But anyway, talking about guarana, so guarana is an interesting one because it contains caffeine or a molecule that's very closely, very similar to caffeine. But when you look at the effects of guarana on mood and cognition, the dose which is effective, we're talking here about something like, you know, say 75 milligrams of guarana, is contains a very small amount of caffeine, maybe 5 to 10 milligrams of caffeine, which is about what you'd get in a decaf coffee. So it seems that there's something else within guarana which is helping the caffeine. And it, one thing that's quite interesting about guarana is about caffeine is that it has two effects. One is that it has this chemical effect on these monoamines, similar to the monoamine oxidase inhibiting effects of berries, of these particular berries. But caffeine is also a vasoconstrictor. So it narrows blood vessels. And the brain is a really greedy organ. You know, it's kind of punching above its weight in terms of how what the supply of nutrients, particularly glucose, that it needs through the blood supply. So anything which acts as a vasoconstrictor has a negative effect on brain function. But the sort of the chemical effect kind of wins. It sort of outplays this vasoconstricting effect, this narrowing of the blood vessels. But if you have a situation where you have caffeine and a vasodilator, so this is something which widens blood vessels, it means that you can get effects at a much lower level of caffeine. And we think that that's what's going on with guarana. And incidentally, lots and lots of foods like these berries, but many other foods like curcumin from turmeric and others have these vasodilating effects. So they increase blood flow to the brain, which is one of the ways in which they can help brain function. And actually, perhaps surprisingly, mood. So mood seems to be quite sensitive to increases in blood flow. And it turns out that most of the ways in which we consume caffeine is in combination with vasodilators. So caffeine in tea, there are these substances called catechins in tea, which increase blood flow. In coffee, there's chlorogenic acids, which increase blood flow. And in chocolate, there are these cocoa flavanols, which increase blood flow. And all of these contain caffeine. And we think that, you know, maybe the humans kind of choose these ways of taking caffeine because they increase blood flow as well. So they kind of combat this vasoconstricting effect.
What about the downers you might get afterwards, though? Is that a whole different series of drivers that cause that effect?
That tends to be the caffeine. The sort of caffeine effects. Although, to be honest, it's a very, it's a little bit, you know, it's the evidence isn't quite there. I mean, we do know that caffeine does cause this kind of, you know, just we'll all be familiar of having maybe, you know, one too many espressos in the morning and that kind of jittery, sort of edgy effect that you can get. And that does seem to be specific to caffeine.
On the question of turmeric, which of course has long had this miracle reputation, I recall having the great pleasure of meeting Madda Jaffrey once, the great cook, and commenting to her off air because she's, you know, well into her 70s now, I think, that she had the most amazing skin and how did she achieve it?
Right.
And she just said turmeric. I want to come to bioavailability and quantities, and they're kind of related. What is your take on turmeric? I know you've also studied it and you've mentioned the curcumin in it. What's the process, again, from putting some powder in a glass of water, for goodness sake, or putting it into your curry? Let's leave capsules aside for one moment. What's the process between that and effect? Again, quantity and the kind of physiological process to an actual effect.
Yeah, so again, this is another compound that's, you know, got a lot of mythology around it, but actually the research doesn't back that up. There haven't been many clinical trials looking at the effects of curcumin or turmeric on, particularly on mood and cognition. I've conducted two of the studies. There might be another two or three out there. Mainly the issue with turmeric and curcumin is bioavailability, which you yourself mentioned. So actually, if you have a, you know, turmeric latte, very little of the curcumin from that turmeric is going to, you know, be absorbed, and most of it will come out at the end of the day. I don't know quite how you put it earlier, but that, you know, very nicely anyway. So so most of it will go straight through, not straight through, but will go through eventually. But because of this, a number of different food technology approaches have been used to try and increase the bioavailability. So there are ways of doing it. I mean, there's a particular compound that I've worked with, but there are others out there. I just know the sort of data on one particular one. So there are ways in which you can increase the bioavailability by, you know, maybe 50 times or more. And those are the compounds that are worth, you know, looking at.
So does that require capsule form? You'll be taking it in capsule form, I presume. And what is it that improves the bioavailability? Is it simply the volume? Is it the fact that something else? Because I know that even with basic vitamins and minerals, sometimes taking something with a catalyst can assist. What is it that you do to improve the bioavailability?
So in this particular case, it's a process called lipidation, which is adding a kind of fat molecule to the curcumin itself, and that helps it to get passed through membranes of cells, the sort of outer coating of cells in the body, because they are, you know, they tend to be made of fats. So that's one way. There are other ways in which curcumin has been combined with peperine from black pepper, which again, you know, anecdotally seems to improve the health effects. Actually, you don't need a huge amount of curcumin, so you can get it from maybe about a tablespoonful of turmeric, but that contains enough curcumin to have a benefit, but it has to be administered in the right way. And if you just have native turmeric, unfortunately, that doesn't, most of that isn't absorbed.
So the slug in the morning is a waste of time. What are the, when you're looking at mood and ageing effects, what are the most promising foods under research and in what form? Wonderful to hear that raw berries can have an impact. That's great. Others we've said may need catalyst or may need some kind of synthesising to make them more bioavailable. In other words, the body's able to absorb the good stuff. It's able to access the good stuff. What are some of the most promising foods in their raw form and or in capsule form where they've been combined with something else?
Yeah, well, there are the berries, definitely. And they're part of a whole class of foods which contain anthocyanins and other polyphenols, so different sort of fruits and veg and berries as well. And then, you know, a lot of research is directed towards the B vitamins, and there's emerging research showing that B vitamins have a so-called synergistic effect with omega-3s, so fish oils. So omega-3s and B vitamins in combination are important. They sort of help the other to be absorbed, as you said. So exactly the kind of model that you were describing there about co-ingesting things to maximize their effects. And then there's a lot of research intensity at the moment focused on whole dietary patterns. So looking at things like I mentioned earlier, the Mediterranean diet, which although, you know, was originally the big studies were looking at med diet effects on cardiovascular health, mortality, it also emerged that the people who are on these diets were living longer and living with, you know, a longer life, being cognitively intact. So that's led to some trials looking at the effects of things like the Mediterranean diet as a whole dietary pattern on cognition and its ability to protect against cognitive decline with aging. That's important. But there are also other lifestyle factors which are probably worth taking into account. So things like just getting enough exercise is incredibly important. So there are I think the foods which are good for the brain aren't surprising. It's the usual suspects, things like fruits, including berries, lots of vegetables, green leafy veg, for example, are all sort of good for brain health.
And the variety of colours is a thing as well?
Yeah, to some degree. The colours are usually a signal that the fruit or veg contains a high level of these polyphenols.
What happens at the UK's Medicinal Plant Research Centre? Again, great to hear the whole food diet and the right combinations mm-hmm. remain at the fore. But when we get into this whole area of extracts or concentrations or nutraceuticals, using the raw ingredients, quite literally, again, is there really promising research happening?
Absolutely, yes. So, and I think it's to do with, just to sort of reiterate maybe something that I touched on earlier, but maybe didn't sort of articulate particularly well, is this idea that there's a magic bullet approach to brain health. This idea that you can just go in and, you know, send in a kind of a magic bullet or a silver bullet, which will affect a single neurotransmitter in the brain or a neurotransmitter receptor, you know, a bit like a key in a lock, and somehow that will have a beneficial effect. That approach has been, you know, it had a degree of success for Parkinson's disease. Last century, the idea that, you know, a disease is characterized by a lack of dopamine, so you just top up dopamine and you can treat it, and that had, you know, was reasonably effective for those sort of treatments at the time. But it hasn't really worked for anything else. And we know that the brain is hugely complex. It's you know, there are these massive and complicated interactions between different neurotransmitter systems in the brain. So if you sort of prop up a single neurotransmitter in an unregulated way, it's not likely to work. And this is the approach which historically has been taken for Alzheimer's disease with a class of drugs called the cholinesterase inhibitors. And as I said previously, you know, this really hasn't worked, and there hasn't been a kind of blockbuster pharmaceutical for the brain for decades. And that's probably the reason it isn't amenable to that kind of pharma drug development approach. But there are certain foodstuffs which seem to have evolved with a complement of effects, like a whole raft of different properties, which can nudge multiple processes in the right direction. And it's just a quirk of evolution that of the three or 400,000 plant species which we know exist, that, you know, just a certain number of them appear to have developed this combination of properties. You know, there are reasons for that, to do with kind of, you know, the way in which sort of, you know, they affect insect nervous systems and that kind of co-evolution. But back to the Medicinal Plant Research Centre, yeah, so that was basically an endeavour started by Professor Elaine Perry in the UK and her colleagues, who is a, you know, hugely respected neuroscientist, but also owned a physic garden, a herbal garden. And she was really interested in looking through these pharmacopoeia from, you know, 16th, 17th century, looking at botanicals which were mentioned as benefiting mood or cognition, and then researching them both in the test tube and in human trials, which is, you know, really where I came in. And with some success.
Andrew, thank you very much. I hope you might come and talk again. Apologies for the...
I'd love to.
The detailed questioning at the start. But
No. It's so great. Important. It's really good to... Yeah. It's really good to be able to talk about, I think, that kind of, you know,
people need wisdom,
marking research.
For sure. They need wisdom and they need discretion. What we might talk about next time is the inverse, which is why junk food alcohol, caffeine, things that we love when we're having, unfortunately have the detrimental effect on the brain. And we might talk again about further developments as they're coming as well. I'd really appreciate you doing that. Thank you. Andrew Scholey, Professor of Human Psychopharmacology at Swinburne University in Melbourne. And we mentioned his other roles as well, including a former co-director of the UK's Medicinal Plant Research Centre. His particular interest is in brain performance and links of nutrition to the brain. And he is the Chief Science Officer overseeing the research and development going into a drink made with blackcurrants, with the food tech startup Aripa and Grey Lynn in Auckland. New Zealand berries very much in focus as offering significant potential.